Folks, have you checked out the Irish History Podcast shop recently? Right now, I have a sale of 30% off everything when you use the code SALE30. So go to irishhistorypodcast.ie/shop and get 30% off everything when you use the discount code SALE30.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
In 1923, as the Irish Revolution came to an end, large parts of the North Roscommon town of Arigna lay in ruins. However, the burned and charred buildings masked a fascinating history. While war and revolution had swept across Ireland over previous years, few places had shared Arigna's experience of this conflict. Beginning with an occupation of local mines by workers demanding better conditions, this began years of intense and bitter conflict in Arigna. While these events were labelled the Arigna Soviet, even this dramatic name fails to capture this unique and remarkable story of war and revolution in a rural Irish town. This is the story of the Arigna Soviet. Hello and welcome to the Irish History Podcast. My name is Finn Dwyer. Today's episode, which explores the fascinating history of the Arigna Soviet, does have an unlikely backstory. While it recounts the fascinating story of a workers' struggle in North Roscommon, it originated in very different surroundings. Over 2 years ago, when I was recording the series Ireland's Last Aristocrat in Strokestown Park House, the stately home of the Mahan family, Oisín O'Driscoll, who featured in that series, told me he was working on some research on a very different type of history. While we walked around Strokestown Park House, Oisín told me about his research on the Arigna Soviet, and I was gripped from the outset. By the day's end, we had made a rough plan to record an episode on the Soviet when Oisín's research was complete. Now, earlier this year, that finally came to pass, and we had a perfect occasion to record today's episode. Oisín got in touch with the Arigna Mining Experience, which has now made one of the mines in Arigna accessible to the public, and they generously allowed us to record part of this episode in a mine. While you're about to hear the incredible story of the Arigna Soviet, Oisín has also published his research in a new Irish Labour History Society collection of essays called Labour History in Irish History. I have links to this in the show notes below. It's well worth checking out. Finally, I'd like to thank Oisín for his time in recording today's episode and Gerry Cullen from the Arigna Mining Experience for bringing us through the mine in Arigna. If you want to visit these mines yourself, check out the links to the Arigna Mining Experience in the show notes below. I have that linked as well. Sound on today's show was by Kate Dunlea. Now, we began the story of the Arigna Soviet standing on the slopes outside the mine entrance at Arigna, where Oisín vividly described the landscape and its history, which play an important part in this story.
Yeah, it's an extremely dramatic view from up here, you know. So we're basically in North Roscommon on the Roscommon-Leitrim border. We're up basically on the steps on the ascent of the Kilronan Mountain, and we're looking back down over the Arigna Valley. The Arigna River runs through here, which is where the name comes from. From here you can see the village of Arigna, which is nestled right down at the foot of the hill, and across you can see Loch Allen, and behind that is Slievenir and the famous Iron Mountain, the mountain that Leitrim actually gets its name from, the Leitrim, like Grey Hill, Iron Mountain, there's that whole connection. And there's really, I mean, there's hundreds of years of mining heritage in this area. So as the name would imply, there historically have been iron deposits found in Schlieveneeren and in other mountains around this area. So going way back to like the 17th century, there's evidence of small-scale iron mining that then picks up in the 18th century. In the late 18th century, there's an effort to expand iron mining around Schlieveneeren. The Latouche family, who are a famous banking family, I believe their name is an old Huguenot name, but they were based in Dublin. Initially, basically, they're cutting down all the old hazel trees, all the old native forestry on the mountain is cut down to feed the hungry iron foundry, the ironworks. Once they've burnt through that, they then start moving on to the coal deposit. So, of course, if you think like this is the late 18th century, this is before coal really becomes, you know, the vital fuel on which the world kind of functions for the next 130 or 40 years or so. At that point, the coal is much less valuable than the iron, so it's really only used to feed the ironworks. But that's the very beginning of coal mining in this area.
The story of the Arigna Soviet is, in part at least, intrinsically linked to the working conditions in the mines. Today, the Arigna mining experience allows you to enter an old mine shaft, and Jerry Cullen, a former miner and guide, brought me and Oisin down into the mine. As we made our way through dark tunnels, Oisin explained what mining was like here in the past. Now you're going to hear a dramatic change in sound as we moved down into the shaft.
This mine we're in now, the one that visitors actually get to visit if they come to the Arigna mining experience, is a mine that was never really used to actually dig out coal, and that is very different to most of the mining that was done here. As you've said, we're in a shaft that's a good 3 metres wide, 2.5 metres tall, so there's plenty of space to walk. This was not the case for most of the mines that actually worked in, especially when you go back to the 1920s. So the actual seam of coal that was mined for the most part in Arigna is really, like, by international standards, very small. I mean, you're talking, we can see it near the entrance as you're coming in. It's really 3 or 4 feet at its widest. And what that meant was that the coal mining, for the most part, was getting down into those kind of shafts that required you to crawl. It's no room to stand, literally like 3 or 4 feet long, crawling along on your side, using a pickaxe, chipping away at it, drawing it back out then with a shovel to your work colleague, who would be then manually loading it into what they called a hutch, which is essentially a cart that would then be pushed basically back to the main track, where then it would be pulled by rope up. Now, of course, we go back to the 1920s, actually, it would pretty much have all been then manually carted. So you're talking about incredible darkness, dripping water, pooling water underneath you. You've got dust, you've got coal dust. You also have a lot of problems with silica dust. There's a lot of silica in the stone around here, which can be very, very bad for your lungs. So you're in complete darkness, using candles. You're with a pickaxe, manually chipping away at the coal, drawing it back around you. It's always cramped, it's always damp, it's always cold. And then, you know, physically pushing it back out then. As covered a bit in my research, you know, there's a railway eventually built in the 1890s, but it never actually comes right up to the actual coal, to the pit head. So, I mean, there's still a lot of manual carting for a long time that's done until during the First World War, when it's extended closer to the mines. Up until then, it required carters to push it 3 or 4 kilometres then down before it could be loaded to trains. So up until that point, almost everything is being done. They would have used donkeys and carts sometimes, but almost all the labour is done. It's human-powered, if you know what I mean. There's very little help from any kind of mechanical or other kind of forms of energy.
Just to explain to people at home, now I'm crouching. We've come down to quite a narrow tunnel that we're making our way through. And I think Jerry is here with us, who worked in these mines in a later phase than what we're going to talk about today. But he's just going to turn on some of the sounds and you'll hear a bit what it would have been like in these mines back. Just gives you some sense, maybe listening at home, the noise.
In the dim light of the mineshaft, those noises gave me a much better sense of how difficult working conditions were. The noise only added to the sense of claustrophobia and general disorientation and discomfort. Now, while these difficult working conditions provided a context for the Arigna Soviet, like so many aspects of the Irish Revolution, it was the impact of World War I, which was keenly felt in Arigna, that set in train events that would lead to so much upheaval and violence in this town.
1914, in Britain, war is declared. One of the first biggest changes initially is that a huge amount of miners in Wales and Scotland leave the mines. They join the army, they head off to the front. This reads an immediate crisis because, for one thing, the British Navy, especially, and the British Army have a hugely elevated need for coal, and suddenly all the experienced miners are joining the army. So this leads to what's basically called the coal crisis. So 1914, quickly, they bring what's called the Munitions Act. The Munitions Act essentially marks key industries and brings in like extremely draconian rules to try and basically make sure these industries continue to function throughout the war. Coal miners are essentially banned from quitting their jobs. They're banned from joining the army. Limits are placed on trade union organization. And all of this is about securing the coal supply. And now, as the war continues, there's still issues. There's still labor issues. There's still issues with shortages of coal. There's a lot of then conflict and tension still between the big powerful mining unions and the mine owners. And eventually, as we get into 1916, and it actually only comes into force in 1917, even though the decision is made in 1916, they begin to do something that 3 years before would have been completely unimaginable. The Liberal government in London bring in functionally temporary nationalisation of all the coal mines in Britain and Ireland. So 1917, state control comes in. This is something that the coal miners and their unions have been looking for a long time. Unsurprisingly, of course, the mine owners were opposed to it. But yeah, essentially, as this emergency wartime measure, all the coal mines are brought under the direct control of the government. There's a new position known as the coal controller set up at the Board of Trade. So state control comes in, this temporary nationalisation. It's a very radical step, but there are also caveats, right? The unions don't get exactly the form of nationalisation that they had actually wanted. So essentially, the mine owners are given what is really a pretty sweet deal. The government agrees to continue paying them based on the profits they were making at the point that state control came in. And also, if you think about this, this is a period where there's the war is on, so it's actually inflated prices. So they were making huge profits before they lost control of the mine. And even during the period of state control, the coal mine owners continue to be compensated very, very generously. And they're also given a lot of assurances by the Liberal government that, you know, this is temporary. This isn't going to last, basically. However, from the miners' perspective, this works out pretty well for them. So for the first time now, we have wages for miners being set centrally by the Board of Trade. It's not really a minimum wage, but it is collective bargaining on a larger scale. The vast majority of this means pay increases, right? So miners are doing better than they had been doing before. There's also another big change is that because profits are now being pooled centrally, historically undercapitalized, underdeveloped mines, like in Arigna particularly, suddenly have access to a lot of money that they didn't have before, because that had always been an issue here as well, was the struggle to find investment and the lack of capital. So within Arigna, you've got, during this period, wages are increasing, even though the miners, keep in mind, they're also under that rule that prevents them leaving their jobs. So I don't think a huge amount of the miners from Arigna were seeking to join the British Army, so it wasn't as much of an issue for them. But their wages are going up. The train extension, the railway extension they've been looking for a long time, finally happens. So the railway line is extended by 1920 to actually come up basically to the entrance to the mines where they were at that time, which makes their job a little bit easier at least. It also means the profits from the coal mine are going to presumably increase. It's worth keeping in mind as well that miners then and right into the 1990s were not paid like an hourly rate. They were paid based on per ton of coal they were able to actually remove. So what that means is that as the mine becomes more efficient, as it becomes a little bit more developed, they're able to move coal out faster, so their wages are also increasing from that end as well. So, I mean, from the miners' perspective, state control is brilliant. It works fantastically. Wages go up. Their power, their ability to negotiate increases. Their control over their own livelihoods increases.
As we moved back out of the mine, we stood overlooking the Arigna Valley, and Oisin continued the story. The end of World War I spelled uncertainty in mining communities across Britain and Ireland. The nationalisation that had been so good for miners had only been introduced as a temporary war measure, so when peace returned, the government began to prepare to hand the mines back to their original owners. Further to this, there was also talk about wage cuts for the miners. Naturally, the mining unions prepared to resist these moves. This would lead to major conflict, but mining unions in Britain suffered a major defeat when miners were forced to accept lower wages and worse conditions. However, in Arigna, events took a very different course of action. Oisin explains what happened in North Roscommon at the end of the First World War.
In Arigna, 1918, we have the miners becoming affiliated with the ITGWU. At this time, the local leader in that is a guy called Thomas Cullen. Thomas Cullen is the Huguenot organiser. He seems to have been a very effective, very good organiser. He gets the miners unionised. Throughout 1918 to 1920, there's a series of negotiations and successes. The miners seem to get success after success. You find multiple reports in newspapers throughout that period, wages increasing, they're winning battles over conditions. And by 1921, they are really seem to be at the height of their confidence, right? They are fully conscious, I suppose, of their power and the power they have relative to the mine owners. So that March, we basically have the state control is announced it's going to end. The Arigna Mining Company knows they're going to get control of the mines again. The wages set centrally by the coal controller, that's going to end. They announce pay cuts that are going to come in once they retake the mines. They announce that this is happening. And immediately the workers essentially reject that. At this point, the first of these strikes begins. Now, this is called in some sources a lockout, so it's a little bit unclear as to what exactly is happening. The workers obviously are refusing to accept the pay cut, and they're either going on strike or the miners are actually locking them out. But at any rate, there's this period where the mines are closed down from March into April. But as we get to the end of April, this is when the miners in Arigna decide to do something really radical. As we get into the end of the month, the 2nd of May, the miners come together, they elect a strike committee. They march down to the pit head and they, by force, take over the mine and declare a workers' Soviet. They take it over and begin basically under their own direction, under the supervision of this strike committee, going in, mining, bringing out the coal, selling it themselves against the wishes of the company.
Key to the occupation was the support the miners received from the local community. They were the ones buying the coal from the workers' Soviet, now running the mine.
The company goes around issuing these notices that they've had printed out. There's records of them handing them out over the area, putting them up that say, you know, or mine number one has been taken over and is being worked by persons without the consent of the company. Therefore, if you buy coal from them, you're breaking the law. There's actually one of these ends up in the National Archives because it's sent up to the head office of the ITGWU. It comes with a handwritten note written by one of the strike committee, basically saying that not only is no one listening to these notices, but the company couldn't even find anyone locally willing to put them up for them or hand them out. So basically, it seems that people are completely ignoring it and people seem to have been perfectly happy to continue buying coal from the miners during the period where they're in control.
Part of the success of the Soviet unquestionably related to the wider political landscape. The War of Independence was entering its most intense phase when the mine was occupied. The police, the Royal Irish Constabulary, had long lost influence and control in Arigna. However, the authorities did respond by launching a few military raids into the region, led by the British Army.
The police, from an early point, had essentially abandoned this area. And even then, in 1920, there's an incident where there's a big raid. The British Army come into Arigna. They drive around for a while. They eventually actually come up to the mine. They bring the miners out. They subject them to what is referred to as a rough interrogation. And then they go off, and as they're leaving, they fire shots at the local Sinn Féin headquarters. And they do, I believe, they injure someone, but don't kill someone doing that. So that's one incident. Then later on, we have an incident where they're coming in, they're looking for our guys, but they are so confused, they're so lost, they can't find anything up here. So they end up resorting to a tactic that you see, you know, the British forces use in other areas as well, where essentially they start kidnapping random civilians and holding them hostage in an attempt to get the IRA men who are hiding to come out. A famous incident, they abduct a man who's in his late 70s in an attempt to force his son to come out of hiding. I mean, this fails. They don't basically capture them. And from that point on, by the start of 1921, the British Army functionally has abandoned this area. There is no state forces present here at all.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Recently, I had a minor argument with a close friend that brought up things from my past that I really needed to get off my chest. I think we've all been there. Now, I found therapy a really great way to work through these issues. For me, I really like online therapy, and BetterHelp is a really great online service that allows you to make space for therapy no matter how busy you are. BetterHelp is convenient, affordable, and gives you the support you need, but also works around your schedule. It's really easy to get up and running with a therapist on BetterHelp. You just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist, and you can switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. You can do your sessions by text, phone, or video call, whichever suits you best. It's all about flexibility, working around your schedule. At the moment, BetterHelp are offering listeners to the show 10% off their first month. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/irishhistory today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/irishhistory. The company did enter negotiations with the workers' representatives in Dublin to try and resolve the situation.
Yeah, so the Soviet remains in control of the coal mines throughout May, June, that summer. And then by the start of July, there is another round of negotiations between the strike committee, or rather between representatives of the strike committee and representatives from the main office of the ITGW, from headquarters. This occurs in Dublin. There's this conference. Essentially, I mean, there's a report on it at the time. Like, the concessions the miners win are incredible. Like, not only they get an effective increase on what they've been paid during the war, that's what they're actually promised. They also get a reference to them being reimbursed for the improvements they've made during their period of control in the mine. So the mining company is basically paying them for the work they've been doing on the mines while they weren't there. So this is a total victory for the ITGW and for the miners, and a complete capitulation on the part of the Regna Mining Company. However, there's evidence that the mining company know this isn't really over, right? So at the time, there are two main specific coal mines that they're working. There's their mine number one, which is the older, the larger one. And then there's mine number two. Mine number two is described as one of the most promising shafts in the area. There's supposed to be very good quality coal coming out of it. And this is a new one as well. So they're really beginning to dig into this one. So this mine is subject to constant flooding. So it's constantly filling with water. And so they are constantly having to pump water out. So they have pumps at the entrance. And otherwise, this mine is basically submerged underwater. It's unworkable. One of the first things the mining company do when they get control is they go down, they disassemble those pumps, they take them away.
Now, this move of disassembling the pumps indicated the mining company were preparing for further conflict with the mine union. By removing this equipment, they were ensuring in the event of another takeover of the mine by the workers, they would not be able to use it. Now, this renewed conflict did indeed break out a few months later when the mining company broke the deal they had agreed with the miners.
So basically, in September, they renege on the deal. They unilaterally declare that another round of pay cuts coming in. Now, I mean, their argument, basically what they're saying is that exports, coal exports all over the world are down. A lot of this actually is related to Germany not importing coal anymore because the German economy is in such a disastrous state. But anyway, coal exports down, coal prices are dropping. They're saying we can't afford to pay these wages. So they unilaterally break the deal. They say we're bringing in these pay cuts. And predictably enough, another strike breaks out. And as we get to the end of September, sort of leaning into the beginning of October, another occupation occurs, basically. The workers come down again, they take over the mine, and the second occupation begins. And this, I think, is one of the really interesting parts of this story, is this distinction between the first one, the traditional, the Soviet, the more well-known one, the more well-remembered one, and this second, more complex and kind of unusual occupation, right, that starts in October 21 and goes on into, I mean, well into 1922, until basically the following summer.
The occupation this time was not just a workers' occupation, but it had a political dimension as it took place under the direction of the local IRA. Oisin continues the story.
Joseph Cullen is one of our main sources about this second occupation, and he is also, by this point, a lieutenant in the local IRA column. Joseph basically, in court, states under oath that in October 1921, he came down with members of the IRA, ordered the miners to get back to work. He states that at that time, the actual union organizer, Thomas Cullen, and others were in favor of a return to work, but that he went down and ordered them not to do that, and instead to kick out the company and to begin working the mines under his direction, in his authority as an officer of the IRA.
Oisin elaborated on this second occupation and how it was different from the first, given it was explicitly political.
I believe that at this point, the coal mining is on a smaller scale, right? So there's only, I think, a smaller amount of people actually working the mine. I suspect that a lot of those who are still involved in the occupation, who are still directly digging the coal out, are miners who are also affiliated with the Republican movement, which is a significant minority of the overall population of miners, right? So these are the ones who are more committed to it, who are more kind of radical. And I mean, they state themselves that they're selling the coal to support the families of local soldiers. That's the phrase that the miners themselves use to describe what they're doing.
Given the IRA were now effectively running the mine, or at least exerted huge influence over its operation, the mine in Erigna was inevitably drawn into the wider Irish Civil War between two factions of the Republican movement, which began in June 1922. Oisin starts by explaining how the Civil War unfolded in the region, beginning in the nearby town of Boyle.
There's about 2 days of pretty intense street fighting in Boyle. Eventually, as was the pattern across a lot of the country, the anti-treaty IRA are forced into retreat. They flee out from Boyle. They go into the countryside. Something that they actually did in a lot of other areas as well. They initially go and they occupy big houses. They occupy, for example, Rockingham, which is near Boyle, between Boyle and Carrick and Shannon. And then essentially in the days following, the anti-treaty IRA begin in this area a controlled retreat, and cleverly enough, they head straight to Erigna. This is the ideal place if you're going to start fighting a small-scale guerrilla war against a larger conventional army. You could not pick a better location to do it. This area is full of mountains, it's full of small roads, little valleys, ambush points, and another major factor, hundreds of years of mining heritage. So there's abandoned mines, some that are really old that aren't even on any maps. You've also got cave networks.
This retreat would lead to a wider occupation of the area, where Republicans established a defensive camp in and around Erigna.
One of the first things that they do is that they take over the home of the mine manager, a guy whose name was Kennedy. John Kennedy actually was his name. So they arrive, they evict him from his house, they take it over and basically make this their base of operations. It's initially used as a sort of an officer's quarters and an actual sort of headquarters command, I suppose, station. And they set up a very dispersed camp, I suppose you would say it, or a concealed camp, right? So the anti-treaty IRA fighters are spread out all over the mountain range, many of them sleeping in caves, sleeping in old mines. A number of them are sleeping in the old mining buildings as well.
This naturally now made Erigna a major target for the National Army.
Things start to turn towards the end of the summer 1922. So in August of 1922, there is the first of the major National Army raids into the area. So this is when the National Army come in on force. They arrive at Kennedy, the mine manager's house. They find there what they describe as a field hospital. They say that there's a medical student, a guy named Gallagher, and there's three members of Cumann na Mban acting as nurses. The actual wounded IRA men seem to have evacuated. Most of the IRA had managed to go and hide in the mountains before they got there. But they discover, you know, a functioning field hospital that's been set up in the mountains, which is just evidence of how, you know, developed this camp was and how entrenched this force was. So they clear out this hospital, they arrest the people there. They then, searching around the area, they come across Joseph Cullen, who I mentioned earlier. Joseph Cullen seemingly was basically at his mum's house. They capture him.
This is the key IRA officer in the area.
Yeah, this is the guy who's the self-described leader of the Soviet and, yeah, one of the senior officers in the local anti-treaty IRA. So they find him at his parents' home. He's basically brought out. He's made their prisoner. And unintentionally, that results in him becoming a witness to what plays out over the next few hours. As they're bringing him along, They're searching the mountain. As I said, you know, the area is so perfect for guerrilla warfare. The Antichito Array, as soon as they know the National Army are coming, are able to just melt into the countryside, go into the caves, go into the mines. They disappear functionally, even though there's like at least 200 of them at this point. And there's more as it goes on. So as they're searching, they come across mine number two, right? So this is the mine that has been subject to the flooding. The officer, the Afrit National Army officer presiding, states that he sees what looked to him to be fresh boot tracks at the entrance to the mine. He therefore comes to the conclusion that there are anti-Tuareg guys hiding in it. According to his own testimony, without really giving any warning or attempting to search the mine, they take between 3 and 7 grenades, depending on who's describing it, and they chuck them in and basically collapse the entrance of the mine, destroying it, essentially making it inaccessible. Fortunately, in this instance, as far as we're aware, there's no one inside. It is actually empty. This is also related to the fact that it's only the first few meters that are dry. Once you go really into the mine at that point, because the pumping equipment was gone, it would have been flooded.
The end of the revolution in Erigna came in early 1923 in dramatic and violent events, which started with a pretty small robbery in the town of Ballyconnell across the border in County Cavan.
February 1923, a number of men from the Erigna column are in Ballyconnell. One of them, a man called Michael Cull, is essentially conducting a holdup, right? So he's holding a hardware store owner at gunpoint. It's part of a robbery. I mean, this is also an element of it, right? There's an element of what you could call banditry, I suppose, going on as well. There's people, there's elements of like, yeah, basically like robbery going on too, right? Michael Cull is holding up this store when an off-duty Free State officer comes in, sees him, opens fire, kills him. In the aftermath of this, Michael Cull's brother, James Cull, who's a very prominent member of the Anti-Treaty IRA in the air of the Erigna Column, he, enraged, leads a group down. They have vehicles, right? So they arrive in a truck and essentially they do a huge amount of damage in Ballyconnell. They kill the Free State officer who had killed Michael Cull. They wound at least one other civilian and they burn the building of the guy whose store was being robbed. It's pretty nasty, right? It's a revenge attack like that is occurring. It's a reprisal, I suppose you could say. And this basically is, I mean, this is kind of the final straw, I suppose, from the perspective of the Free State. This has already become a real thorn in their side, this Erigna area. It's seen as such bandit country, so uncontrolled. And the sack of Ballyconnell essentially provokes an inevitable reaction. This is when you have the massive raid. A special military area is declared across Leitrim and North Roscommon. You have at least 600 National Army troops are invested in the area and a massive sweep begins. It's during this fighting, close quarters, nasty cave clearing fighting going on in the mountains that, again, James Cull, the guy whose brother had been killed, and a guy called Timon are killed when the National Army blow up the cave, the dugout they're hiding in, collapse in them, burying them alive, essentially. The fighting then, this kind of thing continues. There's a rumour that goes around that gets reported in the local papers that as many as 25 IRA men have been buried alive in caves like this. That's an exaggeration, definitely. That's a rumour, but you can see where it's coming from, right? Because it's coming from the fact that the tactics are pretty extreme. I mean, it's an example of just how nasty and bitter the fighting has become by this point. Eventually, during this raid, over the following weeks, the leadership of the Erigna Column are rounded up. Ned Boffin is the famous name associated with it. They're wound up. The force is essentially broken, dispersed. That is essentially then the end of the anti-treaty activity in this area. And for the first time, really, since late 1920, the Erigna district is brought back under the control of a central authority. And it is, I mean, the area has been devastated by that point. So if we think, like, the mining company, their buildings have been destroyed. They actually blame a lot of that destruction on the National Army because the National Army, during their raids, were smashing equipment. They were throwing things down the hill, all because they didn't want it to be used by the anti-treaty forces. So they've ransacked a bunch of the buildings. The best mine has been flooded. A huge amount of the miners have fled or are in prison. And a good number of them are dead, of course, as well. And I mean, yeah, the area is devastated. Like, the mining company retake control. There's evidence they produce later a list of their employees at this time. They say, according to them, that from having about 120 employees in 1920, by 1923, they have about 25 men employed altogether. And when we look at the nominal roles of the IRA, we can see from that period, we can see the effect that has, because it's just next to so many of the names, it's either deceased or address unknown or USA. A huge amount of the miners have had to leave, had to emigrate to seek employment. And I mean, really, throughout the rest of the 1920s, there's very minimal coal mining operations going on in the area, and the rebuilding is only really just beginning during that period.
The mines in Arigna would reopen and continued in operation until the 1990s. Today, one of the mines has been converted into the Arigna Mining Experience, where you can actually get a tour of the mine itself. It's really worth visiting, and the views alone are astounding. The mine is dug into the side of a hill that overlooks a very dramatic landscape, and as you look down over the Arigna Valley beneath you, you can get a sense of how this history played out. Now, I'd like to thank Oisin for his time, and to Jerry Cullen from the Arigna Mining Experience for bringing us through the mine. Oisin's research is available in an article in the new book, Labour History and Irish History. I have links to that in the show notes below. Until next time, Sloan.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.